Good evening, everyone. We should be live, and we are definitely live. I'm double checking it here with my
Good
live
evening,
detector.
everyone. We should be
We're going to
live, and we are
try and
definitely
be
live.
quite snappy this evening because we have quite a lot to get through. So I'll do a very quick preamble and try not to ramble. As you've probably seen in the chat here, we have the show notes. If you're watching this on the VOD, they will be on the pinned comment. There's also a community post with the show notes in them. If people want to read along at home with these topics, it will be quite useful. I know I've had quite a few people ask about it. If you want to ask questions and have stuff read out, I think Evelyn has just put the Streamlabs link in the chat there. That is the best way to donate. Although we are still monetized on YouTube, so we still can do memberships, super chats, and all that good stuff. And we do get very like I get like 50p a month ad revenue. So hooray for that. Well,
Also,
you've yes.
I'm here as well because this is, I suppose this is technically my stream because it's Monday, but it's also very late. But
I was out.
we are late for one particular and very important reason because it allows Mr. Radical Liberation to join us. Hello.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. In fact, let me just say real quick that I have admired Scrump from a distance for some time. I don't think we'd ever gotten a chance to stream together. So I'm really excited about that. And then I have to say about Evelyn, my favorite line, which unfortunately makes it sound creepy, but hear the spirit behind the words. What is it? I am becoming. Do you see? Anyway,
Oh no.
I've been watching Evelyn's progress with great interest, and I'm a big supporter. Evelyn seems to be some kind of genius or something, as far as I can tell. So I am very happy to be having sort of a front row seat to the development of this extremely smart person.
Thank you
So
for
I'm
that's
really glad to be here.
the glaring endorsement from the one and only Moon King.
Yes, thank you, O King of the Moon.
Oh, and I guess I'll just mention right up front that I do have a channel, which
It is
we've
linked in
kind
the
of
description.
right, and we kind of do two different, really different things. One is my primary show every week on Thursdays, which is economics, politics, history, and I basically kind of talk about what I want to talk about, but economics, politics, history is not a bad summary. It's Austrian economics and dissident topics of various sorts, revisionist history, things like that. The other thing that's been happening, which was we just were sort of toying with it, but now it's becoming a regular thing, is we have a series called Mrs. Radlib, where my wife comes on and once a month on Saturday is our current schedule, and we talk about things like courtship, we talked about birth, we talked about homeschooling. We're about to talk about a very spicy topic, submission within marriage. So that's going to be interesting. I would say there are people who might find no interest at all in what I do on Thursdays who would come for the Mrs. Radlib stuff and vice versa. So two ways to draw you in, hopefully, to paying attention to my channel.
I'm interested to see your discussion on submission. That's gonna be an interesting stream.
It'll be more interesting than you would guess, but yes.
Oh my. Evelyn, save us.
Yeah.
Topic.
Enough of this ribald and frankly deleterious chat. We need to get the serious stuff. I mean the I don't know. We might as well hit the ground running somewhat. I would hope that the sort of theme of the stream would be somewhat simple, given the image that's displayed in front of us. But I think we probably had enough explainers of different bits of Austrian economics through some of the democratization streams and the other streams that we've done that I would hope people who watch the stuff regularly have got to the point where they are beginning to realize that Austrian economics looks at things like time in a lot in a completely different conceptual way than a lot of your I think would be referred to as heterodox economic theory, your neoclassical theory and Keynesian theory and whatever else. And that there is a direct link between the way in which you value things, both before and after, and different positions in any sort of time period, That is the real relation of how you have time preference and interest rates, and it is from that that a complex economy can grow. And that you know, you study any economics courses either in university, and that's never explained to you. You know, thinking about how you have interest in an economy, how money is supposed to accrue value as part of saving or as part of the capital process, just it's so simplified that I can't even begin to describe how it would work, because the ways they tell you it would work just doesn't make sense. And that once you learn about one of the concepts we're going to talk about this evening, mostly it's what we can refer to as roundaboutness, it becomes very hard to then even make sense of what those sort of Keynesian descriptions are. Those, I know there's some Schumpeter stuff's all right, but you know, when I studied a module on industrial organization, their idea of production theory was completely childlike, and it was, I can't even really begin to get into it because it's all just sort of escaped my head and been replaced with stuff that makes sense.
Hayek wrote about this, Evelyn, which is that he said, I have trouble remembering things that don't click, you know, that don't like make sense. They just drift back out of my mind, you know? And I agree. I mean, I actually did some master's work in political economy and studied some of the mainstream stuff. And I would not want to be asked to teach that stuff. Let's put it that way.
I mean, I'm just...
yeah. And in particular, I would say Austrians do believe in abstraction. It has to be done properly. You know, there is a way to abstract away from the details in a useful way. But I think to put it briefly, what you're saying is that we would say that mainstream economics abstracts away some details that can't be left out.
Yes.
It abstracts aspects of the production process that when you leave them out, you just don't really understand what you're talking about anymore. So that you can abstract, we do believe in abstraction, but you can abstract too much, so to speak, or abstract wrongly, right?
Mm. I mean, I might just go to a little bit here from Mark Thornton's very good book, I must say, The Skyscraper Curse, which I think was actually a series of lectures possibly at first beforehand. But it's this immensely interesting sort of idea that there is a direct relation between artificial credit expansion and the supposed commercial viability of taller and taller buildings.
As for those who don't understand things like roundaboutness, just to give people, I wouldn't go into it, but just to give people kind of a cartoon sketch of what's going on here.
Well, I was going to say, this is what I was about to get into. So if you want to start by reading the section I've got up here, then feel free.
Sorry. I was going to say that the as we get into it, you'll see that the terms here and what is used here is actually extremely intuitive.
Hmm.
Oh, sorry, which section is this in? I've not got it open to the right section.
If you open a link and go to chapter 3, just under the graph, there is a section that starts. So they let you say, you know, the simplest example concerning roundabout production. And I've got this in the really weird HTML form, but it's
it's
easier
fine.
In loading PDFs.
Okay, this is regarding roundaboutness. The simplest example concerning roundabout production is of an isolated person who catches fish by hand and obtains one fish per day. If that person spends one day not fishing, but instead makes a net, that person could obtain three or four fish per day. Fishing by hand is direct production, while making the net and then fishing is more roundabout. For a more modern example, example the alternative ways we can communicate with each other. The most direct way of communicating with someone is to walk over to them and begin talking. A more roundabout method would be to first run a telephone line between your location and their location and use telephone to communicate. Using phones to communicate implies the prior existence of a vast variety of capital goods for the production of wires, phones, telephone poles, and so on. The amount of complexity of capital goods for cellular phone service is even more astounding. Phones are therefore more roundabout than the walk and talk method, but they are much more productive. Austrian economics focus on the process of technological change. Investment in more roundabout production processes means the investors are investing in new ways of doing things that were previously on the shelf but were not feasible for general use. Spending money on research and development is investment in new technologies to be available in the future. These technologies generally involve even more roundabout production processes. In this manner, ABCT shows the interest rate plays a direct role in the so-called technological stocks of the RBCT. That's the graph, really.
Mm. But I think, as you said, it is once you grasp what it is, it's a very simple idea. You know, the man who goes into the water, grabs a fish every day and cooks it, and continues to do this day in, day out, forever, is someone that we would describe as a high time preference, because he's not willing to defer the gratification of not eating fish for 2 or 3 days to go into the woods and, you know, not just build the net, but also have the prerequisite knowledge required to build the net and the techniques for doing so, which is something we'll get onto further. But that requires you to have a I think the phrase would be a lower time preference and a higher ability to defer gratification. And through that, you have to choose, as they say, a more roundabout process, a more convoluted method of either exchange or production, or, as we're going to talk about more here, distribution. Because I think one thing that maybe goes missing in some of the maybe earlier Austrian works, I mean, obviously, I think the roundaboutness in the way they're describing here first comes from Bombeverk's ideas and him fully completing time preference and sort of marginal theory from Stanley Jevons, if I'm remembering my Rothbard correctly, my Mises correctly here.
Sounds about right.
But the focus not so much on the distribution, and I think that's a much larger section of the production process today, and the time to, you know, the time from conception of the idea to the selling of the final good, so much of that extension nowadays is not in the design or the production but in the distribution, and that seems to be getting greater and greater as we get goods from further away and more complex methods.
Right, so just to make sure we directly connect this roundaboutness with simplicity and complexity, right? With that simple example of, you know, someone catching their fish by hand, That's simple. I mean, you can literally just stand there, watch the person catch the fish. They go to the beach, make a fire, eat it. You get this production process, right? You don't have to be like an economist to understand what's happening. When you get into roundabout production, that means people start to do things that at first glance, if you don't understand the context in which it's happening, the production process in which it's happening, it might start to get confusing. You know what? Why is someone in Africa digging out, what are they called, rare metals or whatever, to send it to Taiwan to be put together with something else that then goes to China, right? It starts to become complex. The more roundabout process, it involves more stages, often more participants, right? Roundabout production doesn't have to involve more participants, in practice, it starts to involve more participants, more geography, and that sort of brings us to our topic of the day, right? Which is that as your process becomes more roundabout and involves stages of production that are geographically dispersed, you've got this issue of moving stuff around, right? You start in one place and then you have to take it to the next place and do something there and then and combine it with something that's there and then take it to somewhere else to be assembled and so on and so forth. So moving stuff around becomes a big part of being able to sustain a roundabout complex process of production. Mm. Right.
Well, I was going to say to come back around to the theory that Mark Thornton talks about in this book, the way he studied, he looked at specifically the sort of Kantian effects in regards to land value, and that the way I mentioned earlier on that, you know, there was a direct relation between artificial credit expansion and the perception of future value of buildings that are taller than current buildings, because they theorize through their understanding of what they think the market will be like, given the current interest rates, that a building that is, you know, 220 stories tall, and even if we have to develop and go through more roundabout process to work out how to stick, you know, our new record 20 floors on top of whatever the old record is or whatever else, that's worth it. And that what tends to happen time and time again is at some point someone, you know, attempts to make some, not just marginal difference, but a considerable difference in the height of a building. Time and time again, it correlates, or the finishing of the building will correlate with an economic downturn, because it's only under the conditions of, you know, rapid credit expansion and a sort of crack up boom kind of period before any sort of downfall happens, that it would only ever open up the opportunities to build these buildings. But those conditions can't exist forever because they're not sustainable. So there is not, you know, the economy cannot exist in a set of conditions for long enough to sustain the length of time required for that product and that building.
I recently attempted to describe a skyscraper curse to somebody who was a bit more of a layman economically, let's say. And I actually find that bringing the term malinvestment into it at quite an early stage is very, very useful. Because if you understand that things like the Burj Khalifa are like monuments to malinvestment, they are like physical manifestations of malinvestment, and people going, why have you spent, you know, billions, tens of billions of dollars creating this building that has to have sewage trucks empty it every 12 hours because it's not hooked up to a sewage system. That's true about the Burj Khalifa, by the way.
Wow.
They have the shit trucks come in the morning. In fact, they back up the highway outside of it because there's so many of them. It's a great, I think, a great like physical example of that.
Yeah, I maybe this is part of why a quick rabbit hole. Part of why, you know, you get sort of the dismal science view of economics, because, you know, some people go and they look, I don't know, at the pyramids in Egypt or something, and they just go, wow, that's cool. And economists go, man, what waste. You know?
Well, see, that there's the real crux of subjective value theory for you, though.
Right, yeah.
I'm just wondering where we should move on to next. I know I've got a little bit of Mises, but there's also just, I don't know, there is so many other things around this subject, I think, that we can talk about, really.
Well, we could go right to supply chains and then bring theory in as needed, right?
We should go to the practical nuts and bolts of what we're talking about here. Because what we're talking about is how the more and more artificially roundabout processes, deliberately making things more and more roundabout and more abstract, try and extract those last little drops of, you know, potential value from something, has created this supply chain that is nonsensical. It's the economic equivalent of like holding a gun to the economy's head and making it juggle more and more things. We talked about the fish example. It's like if you went to all the fishermen that were catching by hand and you said, you all have to make 10,000 nets before you can catch more fish again.
Yeah.
I think one of the best practical examples of this here in the UK is that they have banned people from burning wood from heating their own homes.
Yes.
because they need them to engage in the roundabout economic process of buying from the energy companies. Because if people can just go out into the woods and fuel their homes that way, and, you know, if they just go out and they start coppicing again, and people in the countryside disengage themselves from the electricity system, the whole thing, you know, the music stops, essentially.
Okay, actually, would you explain this one? Because I've heard about this, and it just sounded bizarre. You can't just burn wood from your backyard or whatever. So what is it that's under threat if people disengage from the electric system?
Well, I was going to say, the issue is more the fact that it's older people who are living on fixed pension incomes and can't afford, not necessarily gas, but the ones that have been unlucky enough to move into new built homes with electric heat pumps that cost an absolute fortune to run. So instead they'll burn like an old style, you know, indoor wooden kind of stove or something like that. And it's not right. It's not necessarily being argued under like any specific grounds. It's being vaguely suggested as a, you know, it's a domestic danger, especially if it's old people and it's left unattended, or if you've got children and there's smoke, and, you know, 1,000,006 different reasons for why you shouldn't heat your home cheaply. But there is also the consideration there that if if more people started doing that, then they might actually have to lower the price of maybe gas and electricity to compete with wood burning stoves, which is quite a funny way to think about it.
Why would that be a problem? Because they've already built out an energy infrastructure and they're sort of counting on everybody using it?
They've massively invested in the green energy infrastructure hundreds of billions in this country, to the point that our energy delivery system is now creaking. We'll talk about, Russia's being blamed for the issues that we're having currently, but it is largely to do with the British green agenda and the fact that we have continuously not shot ourselves in the foot, but shot ourselves in the face in terms of energy production. Energy has become so expensive here that it's quite literally cheaper to buy commercial wood, to buy commercial wood at a store.
Oh, come on.
And burn
the lumber prices are really
No. I mean, it's in like the... I mean, you know what I mean? The logs at the store that are much more expensive than the logs at the woodland shop, I mean. They're not even going to specialist distributors. It's cheaper to go into like a Halfords or something like that, and a mainstream outdoor store and buy the overpriced, fire pit logs that they sell there than it is to pay for energy.
You can tell it was
your electric bill.
It was one of those. It was one of those few moments where the market actually provided, but subtly also showed just a horrendous problem for what we are told is that this great power grid that we have, and this, that, and the next thing, that shops like Aldi and Lidl and even local stores and stuff like that, from about October onwards last year, were filled with indoor wooden stoves in a way I've never seen before. I've never seen that during winter.
Wow.
So there must be some, big audience out there for having indoor wooden sort of fired kind of stoves for heating your house, because I don't think they wouldn't be selling them if they weren't moving.
that's one kind of colloquial example. We can go in. What's happening with the supply chain? You see it with the ships and the lorries and the transport and the shortages and all of this. You see it manifest in your everyday lives. And we're going to go into the theory of why that is, of why you are seeing these shortages, the global supply chain, in quotes, is one, borderline a lie, and two, where it does exist, is incredibly hampering the delivery process.
Wait, speaking of supply chains affecting those, is this the right one? Yeah. Look at this. Sajid Javid to appoint an HR teaser to fight shortage of medicine that helps ease menopause symptoms. Bruh.
Kind of bizarre. HR teaser. You could be the HR teaser.
I know. They've
also
created...
move that window over. That window's too far to the left.
I'm aware it probably is.
It's cutting off.
That's like my dream job. But no, they've given it to someone else.
The HR teaser.
See, what I didn't realise though is that women get this stuff for free for the rest of their life once they're menopausal. Yeah, I'm taking it for pretty much the same issues and I need to pay for it. What a scam. Bloody
they do it for free.
Bleeder privilege.
They don't even get hot pockets.
Bleeder privilege. That's all I'm saying.
Ah, dear.
Okay, so before we dive into supply chains, I just wanted to ask you too, and I recognize that we have the problem of us being on different timelines, because I'm guessing that if you added the age of the two of you together, you might reach my age. Do you remember anything like this? Because I'm like thinking back and I'm like, I don't remember going to the store until the last 2 years and, the lockdowns and stuff like that. I don't remember going to the store and not being able to buy whatever the hell I wanted to buy. This is a new experience for me personally, to go there and be like, and it's been particularly pointed for me because I have a large family, as most of you know. And so there's 10 of us all together, adult, parents and children. And so I go to the store and there's no toilet paper, or they'll say, well, you can have this one. You can have one of these four packs of toilet paper. And I'm like, oh, wait a second. You don't understand. I have 10 people. It's like I'm supplying a little, small business or something, you might say. I can't do this quota. Anyway, this has just been blowing my mind. And I don't remember anything like this. And I'm thinking back to like the 70s when there was, as you know, stagflation and all this sort of thing. And I don't, well, I was a kid then, so it's a little hard to remember, but I really don't remember ever going to the store and not being able to just buy the consumer product I wanted to buy.
I think
But you guys are in Britain and you maybe
the
you've had a different
when
experience.
I was I think the maybe the there's been a couple of winters where it's been a bit dodgy, but that's only if you live, where I was at one point up in a university in Stirling. So it wasn't like completely out in the woods, but because there was, a foot and a half of snow, we don't have the sort of routine with that kind of stuff to be able to deal with it. So shops are sometimes a bit sparse for a weekend or two at then. I think maybe the only other time that would have happened in Britain would be the sort of winter's discontent. But to put that into perspective, that was at a time when, like, arguably almost a fifth of the country was striking, and there was, a
Yes.
3-day working week. And it, my
Right.
mom always talks about the fact that she went to school like 1-2 days a week most of the time because there was no coal in the school to power it.
Yeah, she
This was
went well.
okay, so the two examples you gave, the first one was like a local supply chain problem, right?
Yes, it's like if
Literally
you live
just
in like a
couldn't get
small
through
town.
the
Yeah, like a
snow.
small town in Nebraska and there's a snow drift, basically.
Right. The second example you gave was not a supply chain problem. It was just a straight off supply problem. Like people just stopped making things, and
Well,
so there were less
but it
things,
wasn't
right?
just the fact that there was obviously the miner strikes and stuff like that, but there was also different strikes in different industries. So, other things that shouldn't or wouldn't have otherwise been affected were affected because of the nature of how interdependent bits of the economy were even back then in the 70s. And it's, now that's only just ever more so the case. We are so interdependent on one another that all it took was the sort of pressure on supply that COVID was to bring the whole thing down in a certain sense. And I think this is, I mean, this is maybe the wider point I would really like to discuss, is that, is our supply chain, and furthermore, is the mass mobilization of workforces actually even sustainable in the way that we, have become regular to since essentially World War II? I mean, I think you could argue that between the two world wars, you really saw the start of the kind of fossil fuel boom. And that fossil fuel boom was entirely fueled by artificial credit that was burnt up during lots of war losses. But we remained with the techniques of using, petrochemical compounds and coal and natural gas for power and materials and all sorts of things. And we're still stuck with that. And it maybe is worth considering that without artificial credit expansion, there could be no oil industry.
I to briefly answer Radlib's question and to kind of delve into what you're saying, the artificial credit expansion throughout the 50s into the 70s into the 90s caused the situation. Me being born in 1991, the biggest change I have noticed is in the outsourcing boom, because even back in the 1990s we still had factories. And we still had a relatively large amount of goods that we would consume that were produced in Western Europe and in Britain itself in the 19 in the up until the late 90s, I would say. And the big thing that I've noticed in my lifetime has been, not just the tat you'd get that'd be made in China or whatever, it's the absolute death of again, decentralized production. Has been so noticeable in just my lifetime, and so has the death of like localism and local shops. I think that yes, you can just go to the store and get what you want, but you used to, in the 90s, have a lot more local niche stores that would have, a wider range of interesting goods. We there are goods are hugely more homogenized than they were when I was a child. I would argue there was actually more choice in goods in the 1990s because more niche products and smaller products and medium-sized, chains and producers could make a go of it. You don't really, apart from the very boutique ones, you don't have like you just used to have the local sweet shop that would sell, the Beano and things like that. All that stuff is dead, and it isn't coming back.
R.I.P. the tuck
And
shop, you will be missed.
yes.
That is an interesting point, right? Because one of the things that we talk about with the Industrial Revolution is the turn from sort of crafts, right, where you're producing for a small number of wealthy people who can afford to have nice things, right, to a mass consumer market where, you know, you're making maybe the same thing you were making for the lords and the ladies 50 years ago. But now you're doing it in a factory. It's lower quality and it's produced in huge quantities. So now it's like we're getting to the end of that road, right? It sounds like what Scrump is kind of saying, which is that even sort of smaller interest items for a mass audience are starting to disappear, and it's just kind of the mass consumer item is all that's left. And if you have a slightly offbeat interest, it becomes hard to find it.
Mm. Well, I was going to suggest that could we maybe look at the era pre-industrial revolution as a mass producer period, whereby the in a certain sense the level of self sort of subsistent farming and just the nature of the way the economy was structured at the time, there was more people physically playing a part in some kind of production process that they could realize. You know, if you're working at a multinational company and you work at some tiny element of the HR or the finance board or these tiny little different specialized aspects of the company, you never really get the big picture of how the whole organization works and how the whole production process from the very conception of the idea to the knowledge and the techniques required to develop the products and then produce and distribute them. You know, if you're not looking at that as an all-encompassing project, then how do we know that anyone's really checking that that's going to work? You know, in a much simpler sense.
I see where you're trying to lead me here, Evelyn, and I'll go there. Yes, the mass producer, you know, more people involved, including children. Yes, I support child labor. I've always been very clear about that.
It's the humanitarian option.
Those damn anti-child labor laws.
No, it's definitely a humanitarian option, that's for sure. But to think about it, not even necessarily in the sense that, you know, people are producing, but more that they are directly involved in an end product that they can see. Whereas if you work in a specialist role, you don't see that. So you're not really economizing. You're just kicking the can down the road. It's not really the same, you know, as we'll get into a bit of a lull later on, it's not the same technique really that you're exercising anymore. And I know that's a point that's made by Burnham quite a bit. I think that's one of his books, is it Managing the Managers or something, where he discusses sort of the nature of how, you know, a company that has a board still has that same problem, even though it's, you know, that those 12 people, those 20 people, whoever make up that board are meant to have this big picture image, because it's not one singular person or two people working on that project that can understand it. You still have the same issues. So there is no real foresight or exercise of time preference in the way that there was prior to.
We should probably get into the more of the sources, because we are half an hour in now.
I'm just wondering what order to attack them in, really.
Well, the order that are in the document, maybe we'll have. We should probably just go through action in passing of time, inhuman action, a little bit.
I was going to go from the section alone that describes the. See what I've got there.
Feel free if you want to read that one. Then I just we just need we have a lot to get through, so it needs to be relatively brisk.
No, I think. This is a bit in the chapter Action and Time, where he discusses the methods available for lengthening a period of provision. There's some other points in here we might be able to come back to. If I quickly go to the... I'll need to move this over. No, it's in the middle. Right, cool. There are various methods available for a lengthening of the period of provision. The accumulation of larger stocks of consumer goods destined for later consumption. The production of goods which are more durable. The production of goods requiring a longer period of production, and the choice of methods of production consuming more time for the production of goods which could also be just produced within a shorter period of time. And the first point here is partially the point that I was trying to make earlier on, which is we can't physically sell the stock of consumer goods required to justify the length of the production processes that we have. which is why I would use the term unsustainable to describe the nature of the way production distribution is handled nowadays, but I shall continue on. The first two methods do not require any further comment. The third and fourth methods must be scrutinised more closely. It is one of the fundamental data of human life and action that the shortest process of production, i.e. those with the shortest period of production, do not remove felt uneasiness entirely. If all those goods which these shortest processes can provide are produced, unsatisfied wants remain, an incentive to further action is still present. As acting man prefers those processes which, other things being equal, produce the products in the shortest time, only such processes are left for action which consume more time. People embark upon these more time-consuming processes because they value the increment in satisfaction expected more highly than the disadvantage of waiting longer for their fruits. Von Bevirk speaks of the higher productivity of roundabout ways of production requiring more time. It is more appropriate to speak of higher physical productivity of production processes requiring more time. The higher productivity of these processes does not always consist in the fact that they produce, within the same quantity of factors of production expanded, a greater quantity of products. More often, it consists in the fact that they produce products which could not be produced at all in shorter periods of production. These processes are not roundabout processes, they are the shortest and quickest way to the goal chosen. If one wants to catch more fish, there is no other method available than the substitution of fishing with the aid of nets and canoes for fishing without the aid of this equipment. There is no better, shorter and cheaper method for the production of aspirin known than that adopted by chemical plants. If one disregards error and ignorance, there cannot be any doubt about the highest productivity and expediency of the process chosen. If people had not considered them the most direct process vis-a-vis those leading by the shortest way to the end sought, they would not have adopted. I'm not really sure how much I could go on further and further here, but I think there's at least,
yeah, that's probably enough.
We'll not boggle everyone's brains with too much Mises.
Less Mises, more memes. What he's basically talking about there is that good production is good production. Basically, that if you are looking in a pure market sense, the way people choose to produce things it's so simple, but it's so right, is the way that they want to produce them. And trying to coerce them into producing them different, quote-unquote, more efficient, more productive ways isn't more productive because they've chosen the method that they think is most productive to them.
I think this is more a corollary to the point you see, and I think part of the thing that he's trying to suggest here is that by this want and at least some number of people to seek, in theory, the shortest method by a more roundabout process, that they have to develop new techniques and new technology. Which, is, if I'm right in saying, I believe this chapter then goes on to briefly talk about innovation later on. But yes. I think, again, is a fantastic lead-in to Elul, because this way that he describes here about the shortest and quickest way to the goal chosen, but you know, it keeps using that language time and time again. Elul talks about what he refers to as the one best way, which I think is a great phrase and describes so much of the sort of line go up attitude, as this notion that,
yes,
technique. I suppose I might as well just get the source up and read from it.
Yes, we'll go through these and we'll have a good discussion about it. Don't worry, Mr. Radlib is still here. We're just reading our sources before I analyze them, guys.
Oh, sorry, that's PDF.
I remember you saying you've only really read the bits of Elul that Evelyn has kind of fired at you.
On this topic.
All right. I know you've read Propaganda.
Yeah.
His technology stuff is quite fascinating because a lot of people assume he is merely some sort of Ann Prim Luddite. But no. I don't think that is definitely not the case.
Sorry, that's...
Well, let me ask this, really, not to rabbit hole too much, but would Elul's perspective on technology or technique be compatible with the Uncle Ted view, or do they have quite different perspectives?
I think you could almost see it as the way that A's gone from the elite scholars to his negative vision. Elul is Ted Kaczynski's elite scholars, and he's, he's taken that and sort of molded it. I mean, there is further analytical work that he's done in specific areas, but he is sort of simplified and then added a bit more kind of punch to it. Because I don't know, I find that Elul's almost reads kind of a bit like someone like Spengler or some of the, Mises or German writers. It's very specific with the word choice, which is why supposedly you've got to be quite careful when you're shopping about for translations of Elul, because some of them are good and some of them are not. But yes, this section here on the automatism of technical choice. The one best way, so runs the formula to which our technique corresponds. When everything has been measured and calculated mathematically so that the method which has been decided upon is satisfactory from the rational point of view, and from when the practical point of view, the method is manifestly the most efficient of all those hitherto employed or those in competition with it, then the technical movement becomes self-directing. I call this
So
process.
this is the shortest this is like the what Mises was talking about, the
Yes,
shortest,
yes.
most efficient method, right? And he's saying at that point you kind of, in a sense, you have no choice but to use it.
Yes, I call this process automatism. There is no personal choice in respect to magnitude between, say, 3 and 4. 4 is greater than 3. This is a fact which has no personal reference. No one can change it or assert the contrary or personally escape it. Similarly, there is no choice between two technical methods. One of them asserts itself inescapably. Its results are calculated. A surgical operation which was formerly not feasible but can now be performed is not an object of choice. It simply is. Here we see the prime aspect of technical automatism. Technique itself, ipso facto, and without indulgence or possible discussion, selects among the means to be employed. The human being is no longer in any sense the agent of choice. Let no one say that man is the agent of technical progress, a question I shall discuss later, and that it is he who chooses among possible techniques. In reality, he neither is nor doing anything of the sort. He is a device for recording effects and results obtained by various techniques. He does not make a choice of complex and in some way human motives. He can decide only in favor of the technique that gives the maximum efficiency. But this is not choice. A machine could affect the same operation. Man still appears to be choosing when he abandons a given method that has proved excellent from some point of view. But his action comes solely from the fact that he has thoroughly analyzed the results and determined that from another point of view, the method in question is less efficient. A good example is furnished by the attempt to deconcentrate our great industrial plants after we had concentrated them to the maximum possible degree. Another example would be the decision to abandon certain systems of high production in order to obtain a constant productivity. Although it might be less per capita, it is always a question of the improvement of the method itself. It's so wordy, but it's great.
I get what he's saying, and it does link in very much with the Mises point. I'd wonder what your opinion is on that, Radlib. It is a
Yeah,
little bit.
I'm skeptical there. Okay, so let's say that the most efficient operation, which he sort of implies, we have no choice, right? We just have to adopt it. The most efficient method is to, grind up babies to make medicine or something, right? I don't think technique makes us grind up babies, right?
But it's technique
That is.
that
But what I'm trying
facilitates
to
it.
let me finish the thought though, which is just that a subtle but critical point when we talk about so-called consumer sovereignty, in Austrian economics, for example, is that that is sort of the popular term, but it's technically imprecise. The right term is individual sovereignty. That is, consumers and producers have values, subjective values that are weighing into what's done, right? And so therefore, the consumer who maybe knows nothing of the production process might say, I just want the cheapest medicine, and not know that it grinds up babies. The producer, hopefully, goes, I'm not going to grind up babies. We'll use a less efficient method, which meets with my values, right? And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, he seems to be trying to say the choice is, technique destroys choice, but I don't think it does. I think our values are expressed, even in choosing between different techniques. But I haven't read all of the rules, so I might be missing a subtlety here.
In terms of what Alul's saying, he was mostly talking about the obsessive idea of efficient thinking. When he talks about pure technique, he's talking about the pursuit of efficiency and, you know, the peak objective, in quotes, idea of technological perfection in its abstract and the destructive effects that can have on other modes of thought. He's not purely saying that technology removes choice from us entirely. He's saying that the belief in technology, in almost like a religious sense, the belief in technique as its own technological religion in some ways is what leads people down that path.
Well, then I would say that he's talking about a value, right?
Well, yeah, yes. He's describing
I have subjective values about, you know, the value of human life and morality and so on and so forth. And then he's saying, and then this other value comes in, which is sort of technique for technique's sake.
He's describing,
if that defeats sort of some of the other, you know, I don't know what you call them, more spiritual or moral values, then that's a problem. Is that kind of what he's getting at?
I really like, but Alul gets that in quite wordy in precise terms. Is he wrote this in, I think, in the 1960s,
50s,
in the 1950s. Oh. Okay, yeah, and he's essentially dabbing on the empiricoids.
Mm.
He's saying is that the idea that technological process has a set of objective values is nonsense. And
this is just the point that AA has been, academic agent has been bringing up, right? It's sort of like the idea of, or it's parallel to that, the idea that, you know, you can get rid of politics, right? And it just becomes like, so to speak, a technical decision. Mm. So Alul would just be saying, You can't get rid of values and just say, well, it's just a purely technical decision whether we do it this way or that way. No. I mean, you know, all these choices we make are filled valueful, right? Full of our values.
Individual choices
are. You can't dodge it by saying, well, like you said, you know, a machine could make this choice. There's no human agency or values are needed. We just choose this way or that way.
You've got to consider
and
as well.
Saying, no, you can't do that.
He's not talking about choice in regards to, you know, individuals. He's discussing, you know, man almost in the same way that Evola sees man, which is kind of, you know, he's looking at man from the perspective of technique. And technique in the way that it's applied to man constantly, you know, man just looks like some sort of moldable biomass. And the next source we're gonna go on to from Alul sort of talks about this a bit more. But there is very clearly, I mean, on a grander scale, we could look at history and it's a very, you know, back of the fag packet kind of empirical question to ask. But when has man ever turned down technological developments? We may have delayed them, but we've never said no. We've just said, oh, there'll be a time for that in a lot of ways. So, you know, and I mean, maybe it's, you've also got to sort of grant Alul some points in the same way that you do with some of Ted Kaczynski's stuff to really get the lessons out of it. But possibly some of the underlying points here that he would make about capitalism and industry and other things prior to build up to this point and why he's able to describe technique as functioning in this automatistic or automatism, as he refers to it, where maybe not in all cases, but in enough cases, the one best way to do any sort of thing will assert itself time and time again after its initial discovery. And at that point, it's maybe just a bit of a kind of numbers game before it maybe doesn't become something that everybody does, but, you know, as he's talking here, it's some sort of surgical operation. You know, some subset of doctors implement a new technique and then they test it out and maybe it does work or it doesn't work. And if it does work, then more and more will, you know, in theory, then take up that innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I follow. But again, if the surgical technique involves crunching up babies, one hopes that people would just say, well, we understand it's efficient. We understand it lets us do something we were never able to do before, but we just can't go there, you know, because we have other values besides efficiency.
But
Meanwhile, in China's stem cell labs.
I know. That's right.
Well, you've also got to consider who's making the decisions. You know, Lul is quite forward about this, especially in propaganda as well. That, you know, in terms of the material put forward in society that's propaganda, it must be made by a propagandist, which means they aren't really us. That's why I can't find it. You know, they aren't taking into consideration morals or whatever else. They're just doing their job to some extent. So as much as you're saying that, you know, no normal person or no person that you would recognise as normally functioning would be up for grinding babies to death for whatever process, but there are people who work at globalist think tanks that are happy to put forward contraceptive and abortion techniques into third world countries for humanitarian reasons. Yeah. And that's, you know...
It's seen as progress. It's sold as progress. And the real central conceit you have to keep in your mind when you think about Alul and Ted Kaczynski is the technological society. They're talking about a society based around the progress of technology as one of its core goals.
I might continue with the point here because this might address some of the points. And then there's also this interesting thing about bread that I really like, but. To go one step further, technical autonomy is apparent in respect to morality and spiritual values. Technique tolerates no judgment from without and accepts no limitation. It is by virtue of technique rather than science that the great principle has become established. This is, I'm not too sure, I should have looked up what the French for that was before, but I believe that might just be another way of saying the one best way. I'm not 100% sure on that. Morality judges moral problems. As far as technical problems are concerned, it has nothing to say. Only technical criteria are relevant. Technique and sitting in judgment on itself is clearly freed from this principal obstacle to human action. Whether the obstacle is valid is not the question here. For the moment, we merely record that it is an obstacle. Thus, technique theoretically and systematically assures to itself that liberty which it has been able to win practically, since it has put itself beyond good and evil, it need fear no limitation whatever. It was long claimed that technique was neutral. Today this is no longer a useful distinction. The power and autonomy of technique are so well secured that in its turn has become the judge of what is moral, the creator of a new morality. Thus it plays the role of a creator of a new civilization as well. This morality, internal to technique, is assured of not having to suffer from technique. In any case, in respect to traditional morality, technique affirms itself as an independent power. Man alone is subject, it would seem, to moral judgment. We no longer live in the primitive epoch in which things were good or bad in themselves. Technique in itself is neither, and can therefore do what it will. It is truly autonomous. However, technique cannot assert its autonomy in respect to physical or biological laws. Instead, it puts them to work. It seeks to dominate them. Gideon, in his probing study of mechanization and the manufacture of bread, shows that whenever mechanization encounters a living substance, bacterial or animal, the organic substance determines the laws. For this reason, the mechanization of bakeries was a failure. More subdivisions, intervals and precautions of various kinds were required in the mechanized bakery than in the non-mechanized bakery. Funnily enough, a point about roundabout production there. The size of the machines did not save time, it merely gave work to larger numbers of people. Gideon shows how the attempt was made to change the nature of the bread in order to adapt it to mechanical manipulations. In the last resort, the ultimate success of mechanization turned on the transformation of human taste. Whenever technique collides with a natural obstacle, it tends to get around it by either replacing the living organism by a machine, or by modifying the organism so that it no longer presents any specifically organic reaction. The same phenomena is evident in yet another area in which technical autonomy asserts itself, the relations between techniques and man. We've already seen in connection with the technical self-augmentation that technique pursues its own course more and more independently of man. This means that man participates less and less actively in technical creation, which, by the automatic combination of prior elements, becomes a kind of fate. Man is reduced to the level of a catalyst. Better still, he resembles a slug inserted into a slot machine. He starts the operation without participating in it. I should leave that there.
I just a quick funny thought about the sorry, what is he saying about the way things are made? Yeah, the mechanization of bakeries. What was I thinking of here? Okay, the change the nature of the bread in order to adapt it to mechanical manipulations. It just made me think about how the marketing for products sometimes will include how it was made, and they'll say things like, this was cooked on a metal that was hand polished by, authentic indigenous peoples or something. You know what I mean? So I guess, that the manner of the production is something that comes into it at all times.
You're almost breaking into the IKEA speech from Fight Club there.
Yeah.
The glass bowls with the little imperfection bubbles, so they can be you can show that they're authentically handmade by the indigenous peoples of who knows where.
I have to interrupt and ask though, was that an actual cockerel in the background there in the audio?
Oh, you don't know? Yeah, we actually thought about using a cockerel on t-shirts for our merch because everyone's sort of associates me with hearing a cock crow in the background,
It's a very kind of like, I don't know, it's an unexpected noise to happen naturally, which is kind of shows how abstracted we are that we think that was a sound effect.
Oh no, it's not that I think it was a sound effect. It was more for the sake of comedic effect. I thought I might as well ask. But no, I think
I think we've also conclusively proved that if Alul was alive now, he'd be dabbing on the seed oils.
But I mean, we can look at this in so many ways, this idea of, the organic components of bread either being adapted or replaced to facilitate the technique that provides people with bread. And given the way that Elul talks about it, when you begin to look at production in that sense, the private public distinction or socialist capitalist provision kind of breaks down a little bit because you begin to understand that whether you're managing a state capitalist economy or you're managing a socialist economy or the commune, each of those is in and of itself is a method of central organization for society.
I think the point to bring it round to the supply chains again,
Well,
that
I
we
was going to get there.
should,
But
sorry.
because of that, you have to think about the havoc that has been wreaked on products just so that they can fit into shipping containers. Because once you invent the shipping container, be it 24 foot or 36 foot or 12 foot or however long it is, all of a sudden goods, if we're going along this assumption, and we'll give Ilulu's credit and say that technique does operate in this automatic fashion, then it would be pretty quickly that the goods would be developed to fit in shipping containers better. They would be developed to last in shipping containers longer. And maybe that might explain why, say, we have more preservatives in our food now than we would before. So that even in that small thing they're thinking about container ships and shipping food, you've totally reframed the human diet just by adapting products to the process of international shipping.
I thought you were going in a different direction. I was thinking, do you often need to buy things that are longer than which fit in a shipping container? Because they're pretty long.
But I mean, in the sense of,
No, I follow you in terms of preserve
but
food that's
also
shipped in shipping
packing
containers.
density. I mean, packing density is its own realm of mathematics now because people study what is the most efficient way to put X number of items in a box that's this size? And then what's the
I
best way to
can.
stack those boxes? Then what's the best way to arrange those in the shipping container? And it just carries on and on and
Because
on.
a slight efficiency that you find ends up
It's
saving $1 million or
like a
something.
cascading effect. And to any normal
This
person, they just think they're pissing away free money by not doing these things.
becomes amplified when government become involved, though. From my background in engineering, I can tell you that this operates universally. What you are talking about here is not something you've stumbled upon. It is something that is elemental to product design, product distributing products, and in all facets of especially product engineering. A good example I can give you is the way that federal regulations have interacted with the way that automobile design works. That is something that is largely arbitrary in many cases. It's why they had the separate headlamps for so long on American cars. It's why American cars were so stunted by the emissions regulations and safety regulations that by the time the 80s rolled around, they were these creaking backwards things that basically the Europeans and Japanese were laughing at. These great cast iron, front out bumper, separate headlamp, because that's what the government defines. And when if you get a government that says shipping containers can be no wider than this dimension, and who cares if it's the more efficient or less efficient way, it's the way it's done, you end up with amplified effects with this. Because as you were talking about, and as the law talks about, who decides what is and isn't more efficient? It can largely be a judgment call. People's definition of efficiency differs. People's ideas of, the best way to engineer a problem differs. And from an engineering standpoint, when you get a large hegemonic system like globalized, the globalized capitalist in quotes system here, the globalized managerial system, we should really call it, you end up with all of these little micro steps of malinvestment like that. I can tell you another good work example as well. The size of certain computers, laptops, and computer products wasn't standardized by the function of them. It was standardized by the rates that in the US, UPS and other merchants would charge for shipping certain dimensions of objects with certain weights. Because it could be an increment of $30 to $50 sometimes, which would radically affect the price that you could offer something like a laptop delivered, especially when it got to like the early 2000s and prices came down. So the dimensions of those objects, you ended up with sometimes quite cramped or poor design because of regulation or because of the way that the US Postal Service would charge for shipping a certain size of item.
And then you get a laptop that cooks your legs. No, I think it's kind of funny though. You could look at it as, every economist, or there is a million economists out there, and none of them can agree on what efficiency is, but they all know it's good. But I think the one of the things we were talking about the other weekend is look at the way cars are manufactured nowadays, but they are manufactured to suit, on a grander level, financial techniques, because ultimately, the blah blah, you will own nothing and you will be happy cliches. But for a number of years now, the vast majority of vehicles are quote unquote purchased through finance agreements. And what that has led to is that the vast majority of cars you see in the road function as cars to the people that buy them, but to the people who quote unquote sell them, they are actually financial instruments. And part of the way that they are designed to be redundant, and part of the ways that they are designed to be used and appeal to people, is by the nature of the fact that they are not sold as things that you own for any, as Mises was talking about, the length of production changing because the good has to be more durable. If you're just swapping a car for a new one every 5 years as part of a credit instrument, then the good doesn't need to be as durable. So in theory, it can be made cheaper and create a bigger profit margin. But it might also just be as such the case that, as I was going to mention earlier on, from the Austrian perspective, I think you've got to give Ellul some credit in recognizing possibly that policy itself and economic conditions, which he seems to recognize in some way, is a driver of developments and techniques and technology. I mean, as you pointed out in the pre-chat a little while ago, as you've been talking about Nearstream, the tariffs and the what were the phrase? Oh, I've forgotten it now. The sanctions that would be put on Russia and the further sanctions might actually facilitate the development of even more roundabout techniques to get round the sanctions,
Well,
instead of
yeah, I
eating
was just
the
saying,
hit and profit.
I'd be careful about using the word roundabout there, right? Because when we talk about roundabout, I think that we're typically talking about, at least in the theory of the free market, we're talking about a more complicated production process you choose to accomplish your goal, right? It's the best way to ac accomplish the goal is to use a more roundabout or complex process, right? Whereas with the sanctions, I was just saying that the supply chains get longer Not because they want that, not because they get something better out of having longer supply chains, taking gas from Russia, sending it over to China, and then eventually some of it ends up in Europe, rather than just going right over to Europe. It's just because the sanctions are there and they've an artificial obstacle has been stuck in the way between Russia and Europe,
Plus, I'm saying whether the obstacle is artificial or not, though, that is a set of conditions put upon whatever vestiges are left in the market, and the market must, because of that, seek some more roundabout way of production. I understand what they're doing is basically being stopped, but that's just a really extreme sense of that current operation with that production cycle is just no longer profitable.
Well, we probably don't have Radlib for too much longer here. We've got about 25 minutes until 11 o'clock. And we've got around some of the discussion that we want to get around. No, we're not too far behind. Don't worry. I just want to rapid fire a few things out if you want to get the sources up. There's the shipping container crisis currently going on in Shanghai specifically. If you want to get that graph.
I had that up earlier on.
Yes, the shipping containers are stacking up at China's ports as COVID lockdowns block truck drivers from accessing docks. That's one side of it. The other one I want to rapid fire in here as well is the California one. You got an article here from 2021.
Yeah, this was kind of interesting. Is this the Apple News one that I got?
No, this is the New York Times one, where a record number of cargo ships off California coast shows a crack in the supply chain. This is still going on, by the way. There's still a record number of queues. There's still record lengths of queues at California for delivering goods. And both ends of this show that the idea of shipping things from China to the US that
Oh, for
could
God's sake.
feasibly be.
Could you quickly grab a archive version of that Times article?
I
Because
don't
it's
know why you didn't in the first place. I actually already have one up. I'll send it to you right now. Here you go. I'm
What's
actually.
the problem? It looks fine.
Oh no, it's just because I've tried to.
The one we're looking at now.
It's just I've tried to open it and it's not worked because it's given
There
me
you go.
the you've hit your
Yeah,
limit of.
I have an extension that automatically archives all that stuff.
Right. Anyway, yes, there we go.
Yeah,
Article.
and by the way, this is a current story, Scrump. It's April 2022. So you said 2021, I
Oh
think.
no, the one from the New York Times is from 2021, but I was going to
Oh,
point out that the
okay.
one
Yeah,
from
got it.
Apple News is from 2022.
Oh,
Like, this has been a problem that's
I
been
see what you're
going on.
saying. Right,
Yeah,
right.
it is an old news story of an ongoing problem for, 6 months, more than, 8 months, of this horrendous backlog, and it's not going to go away because they don't have the qualified dock workers. They're having troubles with unionization, non-unionization, having trouble with captains. Ships are going out of
Oh.
business as they're stuck in this line.
Right. And there's another factor here. We were learning about these ports is that there's a NIMBY. Do you guys use that term? Not in my
Yes.
backyard. Yeah.
Yes, we use
There's
that.
a NIMBY issue where, as they need to build ports out, in part to deal with these kinds of problems, they're just not getting permits or whatever. They're not getting through the local governments to get the ports built. And so, you don't see that right away. Right, the fact that there's not the ports we need, because that's something they're going to start on years before you really need the port to be online, right? But I think what I'm gathering is that more recently we're actually seeing that all those no's to building ports have left a number of ports that are straining, and the kinds of problems you're bringing up are now becoming manifest, right? Which is problems with the Oh, could you bring in Evelyn that democracy of the
Well,
ports point? That was really interesting.
this is what I was going to say. One of the things that really kind of inspired me to actually just sort of look at this sort of issue all as one thing. I'll quickly copy the link, post it in chat for people. It's in the docket, but it's a Wall Street Journal documentary, I think, on like the supply chain collapse or whatever they call it. But I noticed at one point in it, they admitted that the problem they're having, and I think it's specifically at this big port in California that I think they were talking about in the documentary, is that the decision making for how cargo is handled is democratic, as they described it. So there is no one singular body that manages the freight from the ship to the holding area to the truck. There is all different separate entities that operate these factors, And because of that, and then because you get unions on top of that, and you know all these different bodies that have to agree on, you know, a schedule change, or you know we're bringing in 9 ships this month, not 8, so we need to divvy up hours, and then having a disagreement about that, the work doesn't get done.
Yeah, I remember the lady in that documentary used a really good example where they wanted to go to 24/7 because they were stacked up and they wanted to clear out their backlog, right? And she said, well, you know, okay, so say we convince the dock workers to load the trucks, and we convince the truckers to, you know, at 3 a.m. and the truckers to show up at 3 a.m. In the middle of the night to take this. Well, okay, but now you've got to convince the people where the truckers go to take the shipment in the middle of the night, right? Or you just end up backed up at a different point.
Mm.
So the coordination in the system becomes really like, you know, and there isn't some overlord who can just say, okay, everybody, we're going to 24/7. You just have to work at 3 a.m.
Not yet. There's not.
It's not that simple. Yeah, not yet, right.
Because I have family that work in one of the bigger ports in Britain now, in Felixstowe. And I have confirmation from them that, you know, because I was talking to them about the nature of their job. And they said to me, like, you know, I've got a timetable up for the trains, I've got a timetable up for trucks, I've got a timetable up for the ships, I've got 2 separate databases up for tracking the containers on the port, because you need to have 2 in case one of them is wrong. So you've got like 6 different things up, and you're having to organise between all 6 of these and read them yourself, and you know, which is how things are normally done. However, I found it at the time thinking, why isn't that automated? And when I asked them why it's not automated, they went, well, it's going to be automated in the near future. And I think they're trialling it in the UK in a matter of months. I mean, I'm expecting at some point before the year out for us to have some horrendous disaster that's going to make all this stuff look like a bit of a picnic when this sort of automated system that they want to launch, that's, you know, it's going to read the ship in, it's going to stack the crate where it needs to be based on where it thinks lorries are going to be and trains are going to be in a certain number of hours and so on and so forth. But consequently, what that does is that eliminates that democratic decision-making. You know, it really goes to show, as Alua would describe, the sort of autocratic nature of technique as it's applied to production processes. You know, whether or not we agree with the fact that we think the drivers of the lorries should work 12 hours of 8, they've now been completely removed of that ability to choose, because there's now a computer that decides when you will and won't pick up, you know, haulage or container ships. And if you don't, someone else will do it. So, you know, tough luck.
Yeah, and if you can't find anyone in your nation will do it, they'll ship someone in from another nation to do it. It's the global workforce.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
The point I wanted to make, though, about all of this stuff is that these problems did not exist really in these exacerbated forms up until the 1990s, until the rank outsourcing of the Clinton administration and the rank outsourcing of the, you know, the Blair administration, really, in the UK, and when things got really bad.
And the Thatcher government, let's be honest.
Well, a lot of that was just trying to make sure that the ship, you know, was plugging holes in the communist ship.
It wasn't just that. It was, let's take all these aspects of, you know, the state capitalism, like the coal board and the iron board and all these different things, and basically sell them to the Chinese and the Indians at a discount value so that they can just make the steel and the coal for us.
I'm confused, Scrum. You're saying that we didn't have supply chain problems before the 90s?
No, I'm saying that the supply chain was actually a lot simpler before the 1990s, when there was a lot more domestic industry. People forget until the early 90s how much of America's consumed goods were made in America. The big example I bring up is silicon foundries. Up until the 1990s, most of the world's microchips were still made in America to the degree of something like 80%. And now something like 80% of them are not made in America.
Right.
And that's been a shift over the course of 30 years.
Something that is interesting to me, you know about just-in-time inventory.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes.
Yeah, and that's the idea that for efficiency reasons and others, you don't want to have massive warehouses of stuff that just sits there for weeks and weeks and weeks. You'd rather, if you could do it, get things just as you need them, right? So that you're not stockpiling huge amounts of inventory at various points along the supply chain. It's mostly just sort of flowing through with not a lot of not a lot of stockpiling. So that's just-in-time inventory. An interesting thing was to see people questioning it in the face of the shortages during the lockdowns. It was sort of, I think it was sort of a shock to people to go, oh, wait, people want to buy this thing from me, and I literally just don't have any, and I'm not
Yes.
gonna have any for like months. And then they
I
went, you know, maybe I should have had a warehouse full of stuff, you know, and this just-in-time
especially yeah.
inventory doesn't always work out. That was quite
Especially
interesting.
if your manufacturer is in China. I've witnessed this
Right.
process continuously in the engineering sector. Of what will happen is a whole bunch of companies will be cut, you know, will be swooned by a Chinese manufacturer with a British company contracting for it. They'll all go over to let's say one of the examples was Springs, actually. When I was in school, they couldn't find anyone who would make springs with a consistent K constant. They were trying to get students to make their own Newton meters, and they could not, for love nor money, get a properly tempered spring. And the reason was all these springs were now made for non-precision purposes in the same factory in China, and nobody really makes calibrated springs anymore. At least not, you know, that you can find in a reasonable way. And that's something that happened to the supply chain. And, you know, my physics teacher was very surprised by that, because this is something that changed in the last kind of couple of years, that
Right.
everyone had switched over to the same spring supplier, and they were just making, you know, essentially shit. And it happens all the time with companies who switch to outsource suppliers, that they'll have two good batches of products at first, maybe. They'll fulfill like the contractual obligation that they're meant to fulfill, and then what they will get is they will get dump steel, and they will get dangerous products in many ways. But there is no choice when you get to the more roundabout system, and to bring back in the malinvestment and the way the government interfaces with this. Once you have governments encouraging this process, feeding cheap credit, manipulating interest rates, it becomes an irreversible cycle where you have to keep doing this or you die. And what Evelyn brought up with the Alul stuff is that in a credit expansion bubble, in a government-mandated malinvestment environment, the mo quote unquote most efficient way of doing things is dictated by this credit environment. It's dictated by this legislative environment, and you end up with technology born of the credit bubble, the credit expansion, and this horrendous warping of time preference that gets drilled into people generation after generation, like you talked about with just in time, that this is the way we do things. And when eventually reality reasserts itself, they don't know how to do things anymore.
Well, see, I.
Oh, now that is a very interesting
I want to take
point you
that
make,
further.
that you can literally just lose. We do lose knowledge. I mean, we've focused on that in the Mrs. Red Lib streams in the cultural sphere, right? People want to like try to do things in the old-fashioned way with courtship or something, and literally no one even knows how to do it. It's gone, right? So you're saying this can happen in the area of technical knowledge, I suppose,
Yes.
right? Scrum, at one time, people knew how to make springs with a certain K value or whatever, and now literally you can't find anyone who knows how. Well, after a long enough an amount of time of going to the new method of production, the old method it doesn't get handed down from master to apprentice or whatever, and it can just be gone, right?
Yes. Check on
Which
Evelyn,
is
you were saying.
bizarre. Go
Well,
ahead.
I kind of wanted to maybe round off with one of my typical, slightly possibly sketch theories, but is worth considering. That on a deeper sense, the whole environmental stuff, environmentalism, is maybe just an excuse so that they don't have to admit that society since 1945 has almost been entirely shaped by, as you described, technique techniques necessitated by a policy and credit sort of environment that produce unsustainable methods, and that we need to keep developing one unsustainable method after another, and, you know, constantly churn through them almost in a rate nowadays where I think you could look at, you know, the one that's always talked about is like the graph of computer chip development and the fact that it's exponential and it doubles every so many years and this, that, and the next thing. That maybe all the language about things being as an unsustainable environment is just their excuse to collapse a supply chain that they know was going to burst anyway.
And that, that's interesting.
And that's why it's, you know, that's why it's centered around fossil fuels. Because think about, you know, that the entire supply chain, the worst aspects of it are plastic crap that's made out of oil residue that's then shipped on big boats that burn loads of oil and gas and is then brought to people who, you know, that live in big fancy homes that burn too much gas on electric heat, or sorry, burn too much energy on electric heat pumps. And, you know, it would just seem to me that there is an unsustainable environment in regards to production across, you know, the entire chain of labour, from some of the most simple jobs to some of the most complex ones, because they all revolve around a dependency on oil. And I don't just mean that as a dependency on the quantity of oil being there, but the dependency upon the fact that an oil-based economy is sustainable in regards to time preference and the length of production chains.
Yeah. Right, yeah. You had the acronym, but I don't think you spelled it out earlier, the Austrian theory of the business cycle, right? And the whole notion there is that you can have an economy that's functioning in a way that actually can't last. Right. And in the case of the Austrian theory of the business cycle, how is it that it could be unsustainable? It's because consumers are trying to consume more at the same time as producers are trying to make more and more roundabout processes. And these are not meshing with the actual resources in the world.
Mm.
Right. And so eventually reality intrudes and you realize, okay, wait, we can't both do these super roundabout complicated processes and consume at the level we're consuming it. We actually are just running out of real goods, well, real stuff in the world.
Because production is in and of itself consumption, and more roundabout production is, we could assume, a more consumptive form of production. As you're saying, it leaves no capital left, shall we say.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I'm trying to draw the analogy then from the Austrian theory of the business cycle to what you're saying here. Help me bring it home. It was clear in my mind a moment ago that we've got artificially stimulated processes, right?
Yes, you've got artificially stimulated processes, you've got large amounts of malinvestment, you have artificially more roundabout processes that burn up all this capital that doesn't actually really exist. It's all fiat capital.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe part of an angle to bring on this to think about it is the push towards globalization, right?
I think there's
a natural thing that happens in the market economy because of what we talked about, roundabout processes and so forth, and trade, right? There's a natural, organic, and I would think proper way in which we become more interrelated across the world. But I get the feeling, and maybe I'm paranoid here, but I get the feeling that there's been forces pushing us to be even more globalized and interrelated than would happen naturally.
Mm.
But through just organic market forces. I know. Doesn't that seem crazy? and you know, we referred to it. You referred to it earlier with, mass immigration. You know, we'll just pipe workers in, you know, if we need them and so forth. Even if the people there don't particularly want that. So that is, they're pushing for a kind of roundaboutness and globalization that is beyond what the market is really asking for.
Well, I think
to round out your point, you were talking about skills being lost. The very simplistic example we gave was of the net fishing and the hand fishing. But, you know, what happens when you can't make nets anymore? What happens when you run out of net material?
It's not even necessarily that.
And you have to fish No, and just and you have to fish by hand until you can make nets again.
No,
And people don't know how to fish by hand
it's
anymore.
more the fact that if you keep building nets forever, you starve to death.
Yes, that's my point. It's just that if you have a government that comes in and says, right, nobody can hand fish anymore. We're all making nets to trade with these people. And those people no longer want your nets. And no one knows how to hand fish anymore. And no one knows how to fish anymore because all you've been doing is making nets. You will starve to death, yes. That's really what happens here. We have all these people in Britain who only know how to make nets and they've never fished.
So here's the acid question for us to keep an eye on. And that is the disruptions in the supply chain that we've seen. It would be easy to say, hey, well, that's just the COVID lockdown that was pretty weird and that caused some problems, right? But we'll go back to normal. We'll go back to the new normal, right? And then the supply chain will hum along like it always has hummed along. So that is one interpretation of what we've seen in the last couple of years. You know, that phenomenon where I said, where I went to the grocery store and I just literally couldn't buy the product I wanted to buy. We could just say, well, that was a temporary phenomenon. We won't see any more of that. Or if the story you two are putting together here is correct, that was just a hint of more to come, right? That we've got an unsustainable global supply chain system that is not fitting reality. And reality is going to keep on popping up in more and more ways. And eventually they're going to always have an excuse, right? Just like we've been saying on my show in recent weeks that inflation is getting blamed on Putin, even though it had started months before Putin, right? Or before the invasion of Iraq. Invasion of Ukraine.
Who are we
Similarly,
invading again?
yeah. So it's hard to keep track. Similarly, you might see that we continue to have these supply chain crises, and each time they've got some semi-plausible excuse. But eventually, you step back and you go, "Okay, wait a second. I think there might be a larger pattern here, and it isn't just that, Shanghai is having a lockdown or whatever. There is a larger problem with this system." And there's something artificial about it and unsustainable about it, right? So that would be the thing for us to watch.
It's very there's no bread in the supermarket commune, comrade, because the kulaks are stealing our grain.
The wreckers, they called them the wreckers, right?
Yes.
There's wreckers in the system who are sabotaging our great glorious system.
But I would go even further and say that what we are seeing is signs that the global supply system, as we've seen it since 1945, has never really existed in a natural form. And it's this great behemoth that the Marxists, they see the effects of it. The best way I've ever seen something like Amazon described is a Rube Goldberg machine of human misery, because that's how it functions. You have all these people who are backed into a corner and are subsistence living like medieval peasants, but without the legal protection that they actually got, because they got very heavy. That's a whole stream in its own, but and the system we're seeing, just all it is it's like you have an engine that just feeds on humans, and you have to keep feeding it to feeding them to it, or else it doesn't keep functioning.
Right, but it's not sustainable because
No.
eventually people get sick of
And
it.
that's why we'll
Yes.
be buying tins of soy grits that are proudly stamped with Made in Britain on them, because we now have the ability to develop uniform techniques so that we can supply food across the globe, but on a decentralized network.
The pod,
Soy grits made by Brits for Brits. There'll be like a there'll be a Union Jack and a tin with a big bulldog giving
I
a
was gonna say
thumbs
there'll
up
be a
in
big,
that.
there'll be Boris Beans,
Yeah, Boris beans. Buy the
Bonkers
Boris
Boris
beans
Beans.
boil. Oh,
Oh
right.
dear.
I suppose we're getting rather close to 11 o'clock, so we should probably head off. I'm just gonna
Oh, there's a
mention.
couple. There's a couple of donations we've had here. We'll read them after Mr. Radley
Yeah,
has gone. Probably.
no. If there's not that many, let's just go for it and
There's
wrap it up
only
that
three
way.
here.
I've got a little bit of flex.
Glowy has given us a couple of donations. He said, anyone who says that they want valueless, non-moralistic decisions are fools. No decisions can be made without values. In order to make a choice, you need to have an object, which means that which impedes. But basically, he's saying that non-value-free judgment is false, which I agree with. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he also, true. Thank you for the $3 there. Thank you for the other $3 saying, most efficient way to balance the budget is to get rid of dependents, such as the homeless and elderly. Most people would frown on this for good reason. We'll bring back the Obama boards. anyway, those were the only... Oh, and another dollar donation saying, one of the reasons stores don't have much stock of stuff is because warehouses are taxed. Yeah, they're taxed for inventory. I forget what the, yeah, basically they are, you are taxed for inventory in many localities.
I did not know that.
Yes.
I did not know that, really.
Yeah.
So that pushes people towards a just-in-time inventory,
well, so...
because anything that sits there, even if, you know, that would prepare you better for a crisis, right? We just learned recently, it doesn't matter. They're going to punish you so bad with taxes for having an inventory pile up that you're going to go, yeah, well, if the crisis comes, that'll just be tough luck then, I guess.
Yep.
Wow, I didn't even think about that, inventory being taxed.
We've got to think as well.
It's on your balance sheet still. It's still an asset that you have.
Land values,
right,
and
okay.
Land tax,
yeah.
And security costs, and you know, they're just the direct canteen effects of the values of land, basically making holding stock more expensive than possibly the risk of not having stock in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, no,
but I mean, I would think some of these things are sort of natural factors, you might say, right? Like the you know, the cost of buying land and building a warehouse and all that. That's just going to be there. But it what interests me, of course, as an Austrian, are the unnatural factors, like effectively taxing inventory that's sitting there. Because yes, yeah, it makes perfect sense now that you say it. It's on your balance sheet. You own it. While it's sitting in the aircraft in the warehouse, or I say own it with scare quotes. You own it for real. You own it, and they tax you on what you own, basically. Right?
Yes.
And so it artificially induces trying to get to the hot potato. Do you guys have that? The hot potato. Mm,
yeah, yeah, hot
you,
potato.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to get that inventory out of the warehouse as quick as you can, because as it sits there, it's costing you not just the normal natural costs, but the government hitting you up, you know, looting you while it's sitting there in your warehouse, right?
Yes. Essentially, yes. Among other things, along with insurance costs as well, you also have to insure the value of any goods that you hold generally. And
mm-hmm.
A lot of that is
mandated
by law. Again, government, you know, you could choose to take the risk, but you can't choose to take the risk in many aspects. I know you have to go very soon, but I would say what is... I know we've gone through a lot of slightly unfamiliar stuff here, but what is your kind of take on what is going on with the global supply, like your final kind of take on what is going on with the global supply chains? How worried are you about the potential of an actual collapse, would you say?
I don't know. I mean, okay, so we've talked about, I'll bring in the other factor. First of all, I want to say, I think Evelyn really brought up a lot of points, the food for thought for me. I'll just bring up the other side of this, bringing the sanction topic back in real quick.
Yes.
Which is that we were talking about how all these sanctions on Russia, and remember, in the case of Russia, they particular provider of like what we would think of as sort of like raw goods, right? Like they'll provide the oil and it'll get refined somewhere else, or that sort of thing, you know, and timber and things like that. And so the idea was, okay, well, we're going to punish Russia for what it's doing militarily, and so we're going to stop it from selling gas and oil and wood and things like that. And it turns out that had essentially no effect on Russia. Now it brought prices up for the continent, for, you know, the part of Europe that was participating in these sanctions. But the thing about something like oil, say, is that it's fungible. That is, ultimately, you don't really know where oil comes from. It doesn't have like a thumbprint on it saying this came from Russia or this came from Venezuela, right? So as long as Russia, for example, can sell to anyone and get their oil into the world market, they just end up getting essentially the world market price for the oil.
Yes.
Right? And so unless your sanctions are 100%, basically, unless you can literally blockade Russia, and look at a map and think about trying to blockade Russia, right? Unless you can literally blockade Russia entirely and not have anyone buy from them, they're basically going to be able to sell their oil, right? And so this is a, this shows a little bit of, to just to balance our discussion of some of the fragility and artificiality of the system, this shows where there's some resilience, right? That is, you know, right now it's sanctions, but let's imagine that there's severe supply chain problems or people are blowing up pipelines that go from Russia to Europe someday or something. But it doesn't matter. Russia will just, you know, it'll go the long way around. It'll increase a certain fixed cost will be added for the shipping, right, for the transport. But we'll still have oil, right? So, yes, I think there could be something like a bust, right, a correction in the same way that we talked about with Austrian theory of the business cycle. There could be some kind of big correction, and maybe there has been to some degree already. I haven't dug into it. Where people are keeping a little more in their warehouse and shortening their supply chains a bit because they'd like to be a little more resilient to crisis, having gone through the lockdowns, for example, or now more recently, the effects of sanctions. But I'm not too worried about like suddenly next year we're in the post-apocalyptic scenario and, you know, the Mad Max scenario, right? Driving around looting people for their gasoline and stuff. I'm not too worried about that. I think there could be a correction and it could be painful. And if our governments do what they usually do, they'll find some way to make the pain take longer than it needs to for us to get back to something that's more natural and normal and not artificial. So it could be quite bad, right? Just like the 1930s were quite bad. But I really don't think we're going to be thrown back to, you know, we're going to be in Mad Max next year, personally.
Before we end the stream, I'll leave it on a little hook, because that's a very interesting point. And what we're talking about here is largely a Western perspective. We're largely talking about a collapse of the current Western system. And what you talk about with Russia is that Russia, as despite being what we consider quite a low-end economy, through having to scrape and scrimp and you know, essentially accumulate gold like an older country had to secure itself at one point, because they have massive gold reserves, they have resilience that, you know, Western economies don't. They have resiliences that certainly America doesn't have in many ways because of the stuff it's been forced to do. And it may be that we see an asymmetrical collapse. You know, collapse
that
isn't...
That's a very good point.
...isn't total. The Bronze Age collapse didn't affect larger parts of the Earth. You know, the crises that we saw in the 1920s didn't affect large swathes of the world because they weren't industrialized. You can't have a Great Depression without having an industrialized economy. And what we are speaking of here is generally kind of the Western hegemonic globalized, you know, the globo homo capital, really, in terms of collapse. And I think that is what we are quite likely to see. I'm not talking about the fact that all trade will cease, because the asymmetry, I think, between Russia and the West is actually a good example of this. In that we can cut off our nose to spite our face. We can go, right, global trade system where we're putting some spanners in it. And they can go, well, you're going to suffer, but we're not, because we haven't developed these artificially roundabout processes, because we live essentially hand to mouth.
Yeah. So a good example of this is that part of the reason that the sanctions didn't have the effect, the hoped for effect on Russia, is that the US had already put sanctions on Russia because of the Crimea thing. Back with the Maidan Revolution or whatever, that coup, and so not only was Russia dealing with some sanctions from them, but also it saw what was coming, basically, right? Russia was like, okay, we've got to make some arrangements. So they were already cutting deals with China years ago to sell more oil to China, for example. They were already putting things in place so that when they invaded the Ukraine, they were able to keep on more or less humming with only a bit of a shock, as opposed to, you know, being thrown into some total economic meltdown. So yes, I think that is a really good point. Because of our Western-centric view, we would think, like, if the US crashes, then everyone in the world will be in misery. Maybe not. Maybe just will be in misery.
I think if America collapsed, I think I'd be celebrating. I'd be out in the street shooting my AK in the air, praising Allah.
It's
down with the great Satan.
As a final point to round out the stream, though, and to really hammer home your Russia point, Russia creates grain, they create wood, they create oil. And we don't create really any of those things. We don't create steel anymore. What we create are HR executives with 5-year master degrees. And we create social media consultants who earn $250,000 a year. And this is purely, you know, these are easy, low-hanging fruit, but they are manifestations of what we see in terms of how the malinvestment has affected the skills base. And it is, as much as we see that in the skills base, I think it has rotted out the supply chain to an even greater degree, because it's a very immediate thing. And look at the sources, look at what we put forward here, because we put it in the chat, it's in the community post, and have a look at these things for yourselves. A couple of things we didn't cover, like the Dover stuff and Boris's fake fake supply chain committee. That stuff is just kind of funny and indicative of, you know, collapse in some ways. But do look at this stuff yourself and think about the effects that all of this first principle Austrian economic stuff has on the reality, because I think we are starting to see it be borne out very readily before our eyes. But thank you guys for coming. We got one last donation there from Glow in the Dark for $5, saying only people that don't care about long supply chains are those who have no roots.
I don't understand that comment. Can you guys translate? The only people that don't care about long supply lines are those that have no roots. What?
I think he's trying to suggest that, you know, people who don't buy and live out of their local community don't recognize the roots that they would otherwise have. Quickly before we end, though, I'm just going to mention the fact that hopefully by next week we have come up with some sort of way to work how I can fundraise making it over to the Mises Institute, which I was hoping to mention at some point.
Oh, good.
Because I'm presuming you will probably be there this year.
No. Are you doing Mises University or the graduate?
The Mises. Well, I thought because Turnip would go and you'd probably be the person taking him. No,
he actually is old enough. He drives himself. If you can imagine that.
Lucky wee bastard.
I don't believe him. He looks about 10.
Yeah. Hopefully, we will have something together so I can try and engage in some kind of fundraising and maybe achieve, as I was suggesting to do, and just read Human Action in as many small settings as I can.
I've been pushing for Evelyn behind the scenes to get over to the Mises Institute, so I will be promoting that fundraiser for sure.
Thank you very much.
We'll try and get you some guests on to keep you sane. We'll do like a telethon with. I'll try and pull some stops out.
I'd be up for that. The Human Action telethon.
Yes.
Nice.
You.
Just for shilling, can I do my shilling and then we'll wrap it up?
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, just for shilling, I normally would shill something in the future, but because of the events of today, which I would like to say, look at the maturity of the three of us. This is the first time on this stream that we're mentioning the big news of today.
Don't
and
say
the only
it.
Reason I'm mentioning it is to shill it. I'm going to do it. Elon Musk has succeeded in acquiring Twitter, and a lot of misinformation was floating around about how that went down and what the board was doing and how they were being a woke board and resisting him and all this stuff. Well, I've got a ringer that pops onto my show now and again, who goes by Black Horse, and he came on last Thursday and explained about hostile takeovers, because he's in the industry and knows about these things. And so he explained how they go down. And so those who listen to my show were much less surprised by today's events, because unless somebody showed up who was going to have a competitive bid to Elon Musk, and who's going to do that? Who else has $44 billion to throw at buying Twitter? Well, not a lot of people, evidently, certainly not enough. And so really, he had no competition when it came down to it. All of this was quite clear if you'd listened to our show last Thursday. So I recommend that to you. It's the very last video if you go to my channel. And it's called the Twitter Takeover.
Well, that's some mighty fine chilling there, Lou. Thank you guys for watching. I'll double check. We've not had... Oh, we do have one more donation, a $3 donation. Glowy again saying there's a reason militaries guard their supply lines in war, because they are a need and a weakness. The more they stretch, the more problems can occur. Yes, it's a problem we've known since antiquity. But I will actually thank you guys for joining us, and I will say good night.
Good night.
Bye.
There we go.